Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're talking politics as usual on this Monday. The political junkie is going to join us. And then, what do suburban women want, and who are they voting for in 2018? As the junkie joins us, I want you to think about this. If you're a female voter and you live in the suburbs of Minneapolis, St. Paul, or of cities like Rochester and Duluth, Des Moines, Fargo, I'd like to know whether you find yourself in a different place politically than you were in 2016. There's movement happening among these voters, and it would be great to have your firsthand account of this. So if you're a woman voter, you live in the suburbs of our area, Rochester, Duluth, somewhere in Iowa, maybe Fargo, North Dakota, I'd like to know whether you find yourself in a different place politically than you were in 2016. So think about that and call in 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. The political junkie Ken Rudin with us. Hi, Ken. Good to talk to you again on a Monday.
Good morning, Carrie.
I want to talk about suburban women with you, Ken. Really interested in your insight on this. They ended up being really important in the special election in Virginia and Pennsylvania, also in Alabama, would you say, in that special Senate race?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen, even in the special elections, congressional elections in 2017, in the aftermath of Trump's election, many of these congressional districts, they were caused, these special elections were caused because of the incumbents were brought into the Trump administration. Many suburban women, many white women who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 have shown reluctance to pull the Republican Party line. We did see that, as you say. We saw that in Virginia. We saw that in the special Senate election in Alabama. We saw that in the special congressional election in Pennsylvania, which went for Donald Trump by 20 percentage points in 2016, and then where the Democrat Conor Lamb eked out a victory, last month.
Right.
So there is change. And remember, white women, we talked about how the women, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to bring out all these female voters in her historic bid for the presidency. But we forget, or we don't always remember, that white women, the majority of white women voted for Donald Trump in 2016. But we've seen in the election, since that election, that there is a reluctance for this, for those same women to vote the same way.
So, Ken, this is interesting because the GOP and some of these the senatorial Republican senatorial campaign committee must be having the same concerns that we're raising here, because they are running an ad in Florida and raising the specter of Hillary Clinton in this. Listen to this.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards.
Hillary will not only be commander-in-chief as president, but she will be the unifier in chief.
The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you
okay.
name it.
Okay, Ken, I think you get the picture there. Why would they be? Hillary Clinton lost the election. Why would they be trotting this kind of stuff out in a race that has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton?
Well, why does Donald Trump keep mentioning Hillary Clinton and crooked Hillary at every opportunity? This is what Donald Trump has done, and the Republican Party has followed its lead. The fact is that as unpopular as President Trump is, Hillary Clinton remains equally unpopular. And just like the Democrats for years would run against Herbert Hoover, Herbert Hoover, they ran against for decades, and they also ran against Richard Nixon for decades as well. It's a tried and true political ploy, running against but I've never seen, I've never seen a defeated candidate being brought into the mix the way Hillary Clinton is. But the fact is that had Hillary Clinton not been the Democratic nominee, had Hillary Clinton's numbers not be so negative as they were, Donald Trump would not have won. I mean, that's the only thing that explains to me why he won in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan.
Well, if I may, this is what I'm curious about, though, specifically. Are they using these images and echoes of the 2016 campaign to remind Republican women who are pulling away from the GOP or some of the independents, this is what you didn't like? Remember that? You know, refreshing their memories around this.
Well, that's exactly what they're trying to do. I don't know if it's going to be successful because, look, as you point out, as everybody points out, Hillary Clinton is not running in 2018, and my guess is she's not running in 2020 either. The fact is Donald Trump and the Republicans are. So when we just heard that clip of Hillary Clinton, you also heard Bill Nelson, the Democratic senator in Florida, talk about what a great commander-in-chief Hillary Clinton would be. The fact is Trump's numbers are down. Democratic numbers are down. Charlie Dent, who's a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, who's retiring this year, said, look, there's going to be a tidal wave. And if I were a Republican, I'd get off the beach right away because this could be a disastrous year for us. So you can mention Hillary Clinton until you're blue in the face. And Republicans seem to be doing that. But I don't know how successful that's going to be.
Let me grab a call here from Mary in Plymouth. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hey, Mary. Hi. Tell me how you're thinking about this.
Well, I always considered myself a moderate and took pride in being able to see both points of view. And I used to vote for people of both parties. And, you know, what I considered to be moderate Republicans, though, now are voting with this extreme, you know, policy agenda that I'm shocked. And so I've become, I don't think I changed. I think I'm still moderate, but I feel like now all of a sudden I'm firmly in the middle of the Democratic camp, which because the Republican camp moved so far away.
Yeah. So, Mary, just when you say you're moderate, there are times when you would vote for a Republican candidate and there are times when in our state you'd vote for a DFLer, or what does moderate mean to you?
Yeah, I mostly voted for Democrats, but it was on a case-by-case basis. And like my congressman is Eric Paulson. I didn't mind that I thought he was going to win, and I was okay with that because I thought he was a moderate guy. But he's voted 98% with Trump, and it's like, okay, so I never thought this guy hated immigrants or, you know, wanted to or didn't care if Russia takes over. But he doesn't seem to have any problem with any of that. And I thought he was a moderate.
I really appreciate the call, Mary. I want to bring in our other guest, Kelly Dittmar here. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. Kelly, you just heard what Mary said. You heard Ken's interesting analysis here. What do you make of this?
Sure. I think that a focus here is looking at this shift. You know, has there been any shift among particularly, I think we're talking about white Republican women voters over the last year? And I think we've seen some evidence of that shift in polling, as Ken mentioned, and in some of the elections that we've seen thus far. But we've still seen a pretty solid base of support for Donald Trump. And if you go back and look at what that might mean then in terms of elections, I do think we have to decipher support for Donald Trump and sort of favorability of Donald Trump. You know, you might be frustrated with his behavior versus support for the Republican Party, because ultimately these women are going to vote on policies, on issues that they care about. So I think your caller mentioned that's even a problem if the Republican Party is not aligning with her ideological and policy beliefs. And that's a problem for the party. But I think we have to sort of distinguish as well between, do you like Donald Trump? Are you frustrated with this behavior, or what is your policy position and what are you most concerned about in election 2018?
You know, Kelly, you just said that these voters are going to vote on policy, even though his behavior might be anathema to them. You know that voting is a pretty emotional exercise. I wonder if he's the exception to this idea that, or maybe this is no longer a rule that voters really vote on policy. They say they do, but I'm not sure they really do. Right. And where does Trump fit into that? Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think it's, to be fair, right, that's part of the conversation. Of course, candidates who can energize voters in other ways are successful. One thing we saw with Donald Trump and my colleagues, Aaron Cassess and Tiffany Barnes have done some great research on sexism as a motivator, mm-hmm. and in among white women, and that white women who had particularly sexist beliefs, and we would say here that basically they believe that there was not discrimination in society, or that women fighting for equality was sort of problematic, that they were more likely to support Donald Trump, and this was distinct to 2016. In 2012, that was not the same motivating force for voting for white women for Mitt Romney. And so to your point, that's a little bit aside from what we would think about traditional policy motivators,
right.
But instead for him motivating voters through those sentiments. And of course, you've seen a number of studies that have shown racial resentment as also a motivator for some of the voters for Donald Trump, men and women alike.
Ken, Jean in Edina called. She says, I've always been a Democrat, but I voted for a lot of Republicans in the past. I won't do that anymore. After this election, I will never vote for another Republican. I wonder how that just fits, Ken, when you hear people who self-identify as independents or moderates, where Trump, how Trump may be changing that, if indeed he is.
Well, I think he is changing it. And I think that, I mean, just look at the fact that one would think that with the economy seemingly doing well, with unemployment down, with the stock market booming, with people saying that the economy, they have confidence in the economy, you'd think that President Trump's numbers would rise in response to that, and they're not. And I think issues that were not issues in the past that didn't, for example, guns. To me, guns is a big example, because in the past, I would think if any point of view succeeded, did well with the gun issue, it was the pro-gun rights voters.
Mm-hmm.
Those were Democrats and Republicans alike would run on pro-gun sentiments because the voters would go that way. I've seen more and more Republicans tamping down their sentiments on guns. I think that that's one of the issues that could really change the economy, change the political economy, especially what's going on coming up with November elections.
Hmm. The political junkie Ken Rudin with us as always this morning. We asked Kelly Ditmar to join us too. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers and looks at she's a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. So she's looking at insight and patterns and voting turnout on a lot of issues around women voters. I'm asking you this morning, we've got to focus on, if you're a female voter and you live in the suburbs of, it can be Minneapolis, St. Paul, maybe you live outside of Rochester, Duluth, Des Moines, Fargo, I'd like to know whether you find yourself in a different place politically than you were in 2016. Maybe you supported President Trump, still holding firm. How does that feel to you? Has the political landscape shifted, as we heard from Mary, and you feel like the GOP is leaving you behind? So what you were thinking in 2016 doesn't feel quite so comfortable today. Talk to me about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where KJ says, I considered myself left of center and had voted both Democrat and Republican. Now I'm so repulsed by Republicans bowing down to Trump, I won't even consider voting a Republican unless they're willing to call Trump out. Kelly, maybe that's not remarkable, given that our tweeter is saying she considered herself left of center in the first place. I mean, Democrats are almost universally united, whether you live in the cities or the suburbs, against President Trump. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think to talk about, again, the change over the last year, that increase of engagement and energy on the Democratic side is going to grab some of those people who were in the center, right? And so it allows for there to be more sort of I think, energy, as we've seen in Alabama, as we saw in the Virginia state elections, and as I think Democrats are obviously hoping for in the fall. One question is, for those who are not particularly left of center, right, but are maybe right of center or farther to the right, who are upset with Donald Trump, but like your previous caller, do they turn out at all, or do they stay home? Because I think the challenge, and what we haven't seen historically, is we haven't seen those voters decide to come out in support of Democrats.
Interesting.
And so that's something I think in this pattern and in what we're watching for this year, we want to pay attention to, is both turnout and vote choice.
Ken, what would your answer be on that? Turnout or stay home if you're disillusioned as a moderate or a Republican woman in the suburbs?
Is this a good time to be talking about Richard Nixon in 1974? And the reason,
oh my gosh, you just kill me.
You know, well, but I think of things like that because one of the reasons the Democrats did so well in that impeachment year of 1974 was not so much that so many Democrats came out to vote, and they did, but so many Democrats stayed home. They were so embittered, they were embarrassed, disillusioned by Nixon and Watergate and all those things, and they just did not come out to vote. I think that was true in 1976 with Gerald Ford. A lot of conservative Republicans sat home. So, I mean, we've all seen in New Jersey, Virginia, Alabama, in Pennsylvania, in the special election since then, we've seen tremendous Democratic enthusiasm, but there is also a corresponding lack of enthusiasm among Republicans. And that combination, of course, could be deadly to the GOP in November.
Okay, call here from Carrie in Carver. Hi, Carrie. Thanks so much for waiting. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I've mentioned to the screener that I voted for Trump, and I voted mainly on policy. I am more conservative, Christian as well. And there's so many things where I cringe, you know, with the tweets, and I think I would not want my children talking about people that way, let alone my president. But yet I will still vote for him, and I will still come out because, honestly, I feel like there's such intensity and hatred against anybody who dared to support Trump, even if it's supporting jobs or supporting, you know, and I do feel like there's only so much money that can be spent on, you know, people that I just, you know, so I mean, some of the immigration stuff even is so skewed that I'm just like, all you hear is one side, and feel like there's such intensity of hatred that I'm kind of a little bit terrified of if everything's the other way, then I feel like we'll have absolutely no voice and can't even talk about it. And it just,
you know,
it,
Carrie,
scares me.
I really understand what you're saying on that. I think I'm hearing you say, you know, policy mattered to me, and yet it was hard to even express that because a lot of stereotypes were laid on me because I said I supported President Trump, even though you don't support, you know, much of what it sounds like, some of what he says and some of the behavior that you've witnessed. But it's it's tough to get to break through the noise around, well, if you supported Trump, you're a racist and a bigot and, you know, go down the list. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Kelly, how about that?
Carrie, can I jump in here?
Oh, of course, Ken. Go ahead.
I like what I'm very interested in what Carrie says, because I've spoken to a lot of Republicans and I say, look, they abhor the outbursts, the taunts, the tweets, the you know, the all these just critical stuff, and the bullying that goes on. But they like the conservative views on taxes. They like the conservative views on immigration. They like the Supreme Court nomination. So for there are a lot of Republicans I've spoken to who are not yet willing to break from Trump. They say, look, his personal behavior is abhorrent, and I wish it didn't happen. But ideologically, this is what I voted for. I was tired of the 8 years of Obama. This is what I've always been. I've been a conservative. Mm-hmm. This guy promised these kind of policies, and he's delivering on them. So I think that the thought that the whole world, or at least the whole country, is shifting away from Trump is a little bit of an over-exaggeration.
You know, and Kelly, the reason I was asking our caller about this, Carrie, was, I mean, we've done a number of shows and some national conversations, too, around this idea that if you say, I support a candidate, you're immediately demonized for all of the what negative aspersions, I guess, that people are going to apply to that decision to vote that way, which really eliminates any kind of, you know, I guess, bridging discussion. A divide, right? Like a serious discussion around it.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful when people are willing to call up and express that.
Yeah, and I also think it is an important reminder, particularly among women voters. There's a tendency to really sort of put all women voters, first of all, in one package, right? So all women voters are supposed to vote this way. And so if you don't vote Democratic, for example, or you don't stand against the guy who's made derogatory comments to women, then you are, in fact, anti-woman, and we don't know what to do with you. And I think that particularly for Republican women voters has been a challenge, and we haven't gotten to that point of really digging deeper into what's motivating their votes and what that also means in terms of solidarity or the potential of solidarity with other women.
Erin is saying on Twitter, great conversation this morning. Don't just focus on white women in the suburbs. There are women of color in the burbs, too. Kelly, of course.
Yeah.
We know that, but I believe it's the white women voters who seem volatile, who the GOP is most concerned about. Yes.
Perhaps, yeah, I think so. But I do think that this raises a really important question, because as we talk about, and as your previous caller was talking about sort of what motivated her votes, I do think there is a question if we could actually have a real conversation about why is it that these particular issues, for example, she mentioned immigration or, you know, economics, were more important to you than voting against somebody who was particularly sexist or racist? And so in order to have a real dialogue about why women are voting the way they are, and perhaps if you're a Democrat, try to persuade some of these women voters, you have to be able to have that hard conversation and really reflect on what's behind those vote choices.
Give me some more specifics on that, Kelly. So you're a Democrat and you've got perhaps some options here for winning over some of these votes. What should you be talking about?
Well, I think it goes beyond Donald Trump, right? So to go out and just say, well, I can't believe you would vote for this guy. He's ridiculous.
Right.
He said all these horrible things. That turns people off, right? Because you're trying to – you make a presumption that they're dumb, right? That they're not educated. They're not thinking about their vote. Whereas instead, I think you can get to a sort of deeper cause of that, right? So why were you willing to support this person? You know, despite the things you didn't like about him. So why is it that X, Y, and Z issue were more important to you than these issues that I find, you know, speaking, you know, if you're from a Democratic perspective, I find particularly hateful and problematic in our community, right? That if you don't value gender equality or racial equality, that that's actually going to be a long-term problem for our community well beyond Donald Trump. And so I think getting to the root cause of what's motivating your vote might allow you, we haven't been able to have these conversations, but might allow you to have a conversation that's less about the president and what he tweeted yesterday and more about what you value most in your vote choice. And you can agree to disagree on that. But to have a real conversation on substance might help people understand why some on the left are saying, I can't believe you would vote this way. And also help people on the left understand what's behind that support for people on the right.
You know, Ken, I think it's also valuable in those discussions, and this is something that I've gained from following what Better Angels is doing, but how willing are you to critique your own side too, right? To see the weaknesses and the arguments of your own side. That's super valuable. That would open up more of these discussions that we are not having. What do you say?
Yeah, that is true. And I think that's why so many people will say it's really not so much about Donald Trump, but the fact that their own Republican Party are not willing to take a look at who was elected in 2016 and be critical or at least be independent enough to have that kind of stuff. You know, obviously, this is the week of the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. And For somebody who remembers the divisions about race and class in 1968, 1968 was also Dr. King's death and the rise of George Wallace as a national candidate, the same things we're debating about why we vote the way we do, how we see race and privilege and gender. These are the same things we talked about 50 years. And judging from this conversation, the conversation that we've been having lately, it doesn't seem like we've gotten that far from 1968 in many ways.
Jameson says on Twitter, missing from your question to listeners, and this is the other perspective, or maybe you find the fact that the economy is on fire, unemployment is at all-time lows for African Americans, he's cracking down on sanctuary cities, and your paycheck is bigger, that you will stick with him. Yeah. So, Kelly, that's Jameson going down the list of accomplishments and reasons why voters are staying with the president, even if, again, his demeanor and his behavior isn't something that, as Carrie said, they'd want their children repeating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's again, sort of what's the self-motivator for your vote. Now,
right.
Of course, people would contend with some of those arguments, right, that life is better all around, even economically, particularly for communities of color, if you talk about cracking down on sanctuary cities, right, that's actually hurting a portion of the population and creating a certain level of concern and fear and danger. And the president yesterday, you know, tweeting out, we're not going to do DACA. So I think you have to also realize, again, if you're self-motivator, if you're writing as, you know, a white suburban person who might be benefiting from this moment, sure. But if you are concerned about the betterment of a sort of larger community, those of color in your community, those immigrant populations, then there is a question about, is it really better? Are we better off? And I think that ability to look beyond your own day to day is just always a struggle for voters, and is particularly interactive as well with just party loyalty. You know, how I've always voted for a Republican, and so of course they're going to be better. And so how much can you actually push back against that strong party identification that we all have, and is tricky in elections?
You know, Ken, I have to say I'm confused about this party identification thing, because you see numbers of younger voters who say that they, you know, they don't want to be beholden to any specific party identification. And yet, and this happens in Minnesota, too, because I've seen Larry Jacob's research on this. Many people just basically vote with the party. What do you make of what seem to be like countervailing outcomes on this, research on this?
Well, two things. First of all, for all the talk about how this is going to be an amazing year for younger voters, we do know historically that younger voters notoriously do not vote. Now, there are a lot of people saying that this rising young youth vote in the aftermath of Parkland will lead to a national movement.
Yeah.
Maybe yes, maybe no, but so far it has not happened. This year does look differently. And the fact that Donald Trump, if you buy the argument, and of course not everybody buys the argument, but if you buy the argument that the economy is doing better, that, you know, jobs are up, unemployment is down, jobs are being created, and the fact that Donald Trump's numbers are not correspondingly increasing along with the confidence in the economy, it tells the Republicans, it gives a signal to the Republicans that there are a lot of independent voters or independent Republican-leaning independents, that this could be a disastrous year, that his behavior does matter, decency does matter, civility does matter, and you can have all the conservative views you want, all the conservative philosophy you want, even if you are a conservative. But if you've just been so let down by the depravity in some cases, the thought that more Americans believe in a porn star than the president of the United States is mind-boggling. But I think that it's really the case. And if I were a Republican strategist, as I said earlier, I would be very concerned about that party loyalty and 2018.
Okay, but Ken, you started out saying, though, that when I say, you know, we seem to see research from younger voters who say, I don't really care about the party, and yet then we see research that says people vote mainly party, you're saying part of that is that younger voters will say that, but they don't turn up at the polls on the day. And that may be different this time around.
I do. I do agree with that. And I also think that people who heretofore stick to a party, that may not be the case for the Republicans either. As I said earlier, either they vote Democratic or more likely they are so disillusioned they stay home. That is a serious and real possibility.
Kelly, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, no, I would just agree. I mean, I think, again, it's this distinguishing decision that they have, which is, do you actually vote for the Democrat, which is much more unusual in our system, because we only have these two parties. They become increasingly polarized. So your shift on the spectrum to vote Democrat would be larger, right? You'd have to make a significant jump in your ideological beliefs in order to vote for a Democrat, versus actually just deciding, I'm going to stay at home. I mean, this speaks, though, to what candidates need to do in 2018, right? Which is, depending on where you are, they need to understand the support of Donald Trump in that district, right, in that municipality, right, and then decide if they're running perhaps even against Donald Trump. I think we're going to see this in some Republican races where they're not running at all in line with the president. They're either trying to avoid him, ignore him, or in fact stand against him. And that may be a point of mobilization if the electorate in that particular area is closer to the middle or is just particularly disillusioned, as Ken has noted, with Donald Trump.
And Kelly, have we seen a candidate do that in any of these special elections successfully? I mean, Connor Lamb ran against Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm, but that was on the other side. He could say all kinds of things about Trump. Have we seen anybody do this yet?
No, I mean, we haven't, because, of course, Roy Moore, not in the specials, at the federal level, because Roy Moore, of course, was very much aligned with Donald Trump, perhaps hit to his fault. Of course, he had his own problems. And in the Pennsylvania race, also aligned with Donald Trump. Donald Trump came to Pennsylvania a couple of times during the election and did an ad for the candidate here. So we haven't seen a test of that just yet. It'll be interesting to look at some of the statewide races, as well as some of these swing district races this time, to start looking at the messaging by those candidates and how they're going to try to position themselves.
And Ken, go ahead.
Look how tortured Ed Gillespie was when he was running for governor of Virginia last year, a nominally conservative Republican. He tried to reach out to the Trump voters, but at the same time, he knew that was an albatross. I suspect that you'll see a lot more Ed Gillespie this year, the tortured Republican who doesn't know how much to support Trump and how to be independent as well.
And let me add in terms of Kim Guadagno here in New Jersey, she had a similar challenge. She ran a more moderate campaign sort of against Trump for most of the campaign until the last couple of weeks when they realized they needed those Trump voters, and she did a sanctuary city ad. Huh. There is that, I think that struggle that you're seeing for these candidates where they still need the Trump supporters, especially, again, running statewide, but they're also trying to attract those who might be upset or concerned with the president.
Last thought here from somebody who called in, CJ in Bloomington says, my vote isn't about the president anymore. It's about Congress. Trump gets the blame for what Congress is doing. They should know better. If we had a better Congress, they would make Trump act better. Is that a view that you hear very often? What's your take on that?
I do. I think that there are as many people as there are many people who do not like what the president is doing. I think I've seen more people object to the fact that Republicans are not standing up, Republicans are not providing an alternative. But again, as we've seen historically, when there is a wave, you could be pro-Trump or anti-Trump Republican, but a wave does not distinguish if it's going to take down Republicans. And that's what the Republican Party needs to realize in the few short months they have before the election, how much to distance themselves and how much to latch on. Ed Gillespie never learned how to do that in a nominally purple state like Virginia, and I suspect many Republicans are going to have that same problem this year.
Well, I mean, it's a difficult thing to straddle, isn't it? If you're in a state like Virginia, in a state like Minnesota, some of the other purplish states, right?
Well, that's absolutely true. But again, I mean, look, I live outside of D.C. There's a congresswoman in Virginia by the name of Barbara Comstock, who's nominally an independent. But now they're calling her Congresswoman Barbara Gunstock. Bumpstock. Because they're just trying to lump all the Republicans with the NRA. So it's not only Donald Trump, it's the gun lobby. It's really not a good time to run as a Republican. And the Republicans who succeed in 2018, as the few who succeeded in 1974, learn the lesson. It's not an easy lesson to learn.
Two references to Nixon. We're good to go. Ken, thank you.
It's typical.
Ken, good to talk. Derek. Thanks so much for the insight here. Let me grab one last call here from Nico before we get to the latest news. Hi, Nico. How are you hearing this conversation this morning?
Good morning. I go back to the other Kerry who called in and spoke about being a mom and still voting for Trump. And I'm sort of on the opposite side of that conversation, thinking to myself, I'm a business owner. I benefit from some of his policies. We'll see how the tax breaks shake out, whether that's good or bad for our family. Mm-hmm. But I'm raising a 5-, 3-, and 2-year-old next week. And how am I supposed to look at them and say, look, this behavior is fine. It's okay. You can grow up and behave like a bully. You can be derogatory to women. I want you to be strong men and women. This is your example. I really struggle with that, despite the personal benefit that I get from some of those policies.
So this is a role model. This is really a role model issue for you, it sounds like, Nico. Yeah,
it is. You know, my kids watch the news with us. They talk about Trump. They talk about those policies and what's going on in the world. And we're trying to raise them to be strong characters with integrity who make good choices. And if that's their leading example, I have a hard time believing that they're going to grow up and be strong men and women.
I'm glad for the call. Kelly, I wanted to ask you about something that I read in a piece by Julie Kohler, who says, who's looking at some of this research and these voter patterns and asking why white women vote Republican. And her theory is that marriage status, education, religious faith seem to be more influential for white women voters than they do for the way women of color vote or the way men vote. What do you buy that or not?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this research, and I definitely think that there's something to that. So there's research that does show that marital gap is actually more influential. And I think it ties to a piece of research I mentioned earlier, where there's some evidence that if you think about what's motivating white women's votes, part of that for white women might be the well-being of their husbands. This is not to say the controversial thing of, oh, they only vote like their husbands. But that they may be concerned about the well-being of their husbands to a degree differently than perhaps other women. And therefore, they're more willing to tolerate some of the beliefs around discrimination or sexism, or even, in fact, agree with them. There's this idea of sort of systems justification theory, this idea that you justify the discrimination on gender because ultimately it allows your privileged status in terms of race to stay true. And that is tied to marriage. It's tied to marital status in some ways because that privilege is particularly true for white men. And so I think it's a more complicated story than just simply married and non-married, but thinking about their relationship to men. In this case, we're obviously talking about heterosexual marriage, but the relationship to men and how that might influence vote choice.
Super interesting, because obviously the other side of that is that when men are thinking about how they're going to vote, perhaps they're not taking the economic situation of their partners or their wives, they're not prioritizing it as women might be doing.
That's right. Yeah, it's really rooted in a sort of dated idea that the sort of as long as the man of the household is okay, then it's okay for you. Whereas among Black women, in addition, for example, you know, women of color, but particularly Black women, you see both more single Black women and also more heads of women as heads of households, in part due to high rates of incarceration, in addition to just economic disparities that affect the Black community differently. And some of this all really goes back to, you know, Ken was hearkening back to Nixon. I could harken back to suffrage to talk about the differences in white women's perception and motivation to get involved, and in this case, fight for the right to vote, versus the motivation for Black women. And for Black women, we've always, you know, want to focus on the idea that they're trying to lift their whole race, right? In addition to promote women's equality. And for white women, there have been a lot of times in which they're fighting for gender equality, but their race, they don't have to fight on along lines of race. And so they haven't been as concerned with how men of other races are doing. And so you've seen some disparities in racial challenges, both from suffrage to the women's liberation movement in the 70s to this day, when you look at these vote disparities. And I think the sort of anger and concern, particularly among women of color, color about what are these white women doing? Why aren't they prioritizing things like racism,
right,
and particularly how sexism affects women of color in their vote choice?
Kate says on Twitter, I've been saying for months that suburban women will be the story of the 2018 election. As a woman who represented a suburban district for 6 years, I see many trends pointing to this conclusion. I hope I'm right, she says. So glad you're asking for these voices. And to the phones to Jean in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Jean. Good to have you call. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm wondering about, you know, the issue of suburban women sticking with Trump because of policy. I said, where is the question, where do they fall on the question of lack of responsibility for dealing with climate change issues and also the economic inequality? I mean, I'm wondering, are these women in a moral bubble, an economic bubble where that just is not on the radar screen?
What do you think, Hallie?
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to sometimes our presumptions that women are more monolithic than men. Of course, women have different beliefs on the environment. Women have different beliefs on what is economically astute. Some research, particularly on conservative Tea Party women, talks about how they were anti-tax, anti-ACA, because they believe that that promotes women's dependence on government, and that if you actually want to promote women's independence and equality, you have to fight against these governmental programs. That's just a different perspective, right? So if they would argue that the end goal is still equity and advancement of women, but the policies to get there are just very different. Their ideological approach is very different. So I think that's one piece to sort of remember, that women have a diversity of views on actual policy just as men do. On the same point, in 2016 and since then, we've also seen differences in beliefs on sexism and racism. It's not that because you're a woman, you can't be sexist or believe that discrimination doesn't exist. And that motivates and was correlated to votes for Trump, right? If you think there's no discrimination, or if you think, as one PRI poll found, that men in society are being punished just for being men in today, women believe that too. And those women are then going to not be persuaded to vote against Trump because, in fact, they think that these arguments around gender inequity and misogyny are unfair or unimportant.
You're saying that women are turning up in some of these research polls is saying this Me Too movement has basically gone too far and men are being punished just for being male.
Right. So the poll that I'm referred to actually was taken in October of 2016, so sort of before Me Too, but after Access Hollywood.
Okay.
And so what it found was, among Trump supporters, there was a much more high level of agreement with the statement, you know, in society today, men are being punished just for being men.
I see.
More men were likely to believe that, even among Trump supporters, than women. But there was still a contingent of women who did believe that. And I think we see that, you know, you see that when media pulls together a group of, you know, five or six Trump women voters,
yeah,
and they're not necessarily representative of the whole population. I think we have to be careful about that. But you do see them saying, like, what's the big deal? Right. He just says these things. It's really not a big deal. And we have to come to grips with that, that is the beliefs of some women in our society. And I think, again, I mentioned this earlier, I think we sort of punish women, you know, more for having those beliefs, because for many people, they just can't understand, if that's your identity, how do you not sort of fight for women's equality? But if your day to day is OK, or you feel it's OK, and you feel like you haven't been subject to these types of behavior, then you might not prioritize it in your vote. Instead, you're going to look at issues like abortion,
right,
or issues that you care most about to motivate your vote. And so grappling with this diversity of viewpoints among women will at least help us better understand and be less shocked in women's voting behavior in the last election or even this fall.
You've given me something to think about on an interview that I heard yesterday, weekend edition, I think, or weekend. All Things Considered, gathered a group of evangelical leaders to talk about, you know, how they see the presidency so far and where they're separating the behavior and the pronouncements by President Trump and policy. And of course, in this group of four or five evangelical leaders, there was a diversity of opinion on that. But it struck me that some of these leaders were saying, we have always been misunderstood. It's always been the prioritizing of the policy. We don't expect much from our politicians. I mean, representing, right, a lot of the cynicism that average Americans feel about their politicians, but saying it's always been about the policy. And much as we may not like what the president says or does, he is still promoting policies that we think are the key reason to be supportive.
Yeah. And yeah, I think there's an important point of caution here, as much as I say this, right, to say the idea that somebody has and harbors these sorts of beliefs, right, if they are racist sentiment, they are sexist sentiment, and the idea that that doesn't then influence policy, I think is false, right? But it does allow voters to sort of separate the two things, right? They say, well, he may say these things, but he only is signing this bill. Mm. I think if you start to dig down, you have to look at the ways in which those viewpoints will affect the policy agendas, the policy beliefs that you put forth. I mean, if you start looking at who is surrounding the president, who he's hiring, is there diversity in race and gender there? Is that something he values? What sort of, you know, we no longer have a office in the White House on women's issues. These sorts of things actually do trickle down to policy, but there's a less direct relationship for us to see.
Exactly. This is interesting from Shay, who I think drives for Uber or Lyft, because she's saying, when my female clients told me they were voting Trump, these were some of the reasons. They felt that he'd loosen up regulations related to their business or industry, that he'd be good for the economy. They felt we had a Muslim problem in this country. And then she puts in parentheses, ugh. They were bitter about Bernie. I mean, again, this is that idea that, you know, what I was saying earlier about, you voted Trump, then I will demonize you for all kinds of reasons. These are women saying, I can separate the behavior from the policy. You're saying it's not as much of a bright line as you would think, but this is how women voters were thinking then.
Right. Yeah. And I think from their perspective, it may be a bright line. I think if we start to really dig down and look in the long term, that these beliefs are going to be entwined at some point, that they're going to influence policy. And so that's when, you know, when we were talking earlier about how do we actually have these more nuanced conversations about what your vote represents and what it might mean in the long term. That's the type of conversation that I think we've really struggled to have. And I think not just among women, but hey, if we can start among women to have these conversations, perhaps we could get somewhere and prevent some of the increased polarization and unwillingness to listen to each other.
Kelly, just a last question here. Besides the Hillary ad that I played in this Florida race, do you see other specific strategies from the GOP to hang on to some of these women that may be looking elsewhere or thinking about sitting it out?
You know, I haven't. I haven't just yet. And I think that in 2016, what you saw was the GOP put very, very little money and effort into getting and attracting women voters. That was, I think, led from the top down.
Uh-huh.
So even though you had the autopsy in 2014 saying we need to do this, I don't think there was much effort. And so the question is, do they see it as a lost cause in 2018 because of who the president is? Or do they try to, again, separate and distinguish between Republican candidates running nationwide and the reputation of the president with Republican women voters? And I haven't seen yet. I think we'll be sort of paying attention to it and seeing how that matters. And I should also add, seeing how that plays out for Republican women candidates who are in a particularly tricky situation.
Kelly, I really love it when you come on and we get the benefit of your experience and your research. So really appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly Ditmar is assistant professor of political science at Rutgers. And some of the research that we've been talking about, Dunn is a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics with us today from Philly. Hey, if you just got in on the end of this show, as I'm seeing from some people who are tweeting, you can find the whole conversation on the podcast and then listen when you have time. Right now, lots of people listening to the show we did on screening for teen depression, what you really ought to understand about that. And we did this segment on why one statistics expert is rethinking her support for gun control. Boy, did I get a reaction from you on that one. It's on the podcast. Listen to it. Let me know what you think. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.